Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Before we get into this week's guest, really excited to say I'm going back to my hometown, Providence, Rhode Island. I'm working at the Rhode Island Comedy Connection, September 30, October 1st, Friday and Saturday, three shows. Come check it out, Rhode Island Comedy Connection. Go to their website for tickets or my website, paulmecurio.com. Always fun being back. Some laughs, some drinks. So if you're in the area, Massachusetts, Connecticut, fly in from Mexico, whatever it is, September 30, October 1st, Rhode Island Comedy Connection. Really going to be a lot of fun. And this week's guest, Bob Costas, a friend of mine, been in pieces that I've done for HBO Sports Comedy. We talk about how Bob got started as a sports broadcaster, some cool jobs he's had on the way up. Really fun story and just the best broadcaster, period. So you don't often get to hear Bob just talk about himself. Really cool conversation. And please spread the word about the podcast. Tell your friends, tell your family, send the links around. We're free on iTunes, two chairs and a microphone. Enjoy the podcast. Enjoy Bob Costas.
Joining me right now on the podcast, I'm incredibly honored that I'm being joined by legendary broadcaster Bob Costas, host of Costas Tonight on NBC Sports Network, MLB Network Studio 42 with Bob Costas, Football Night in America on NBC, and a record 9-time primetime host of 9 Olympic Games. Bob, thank you for joining me. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Paul, stop. You've lowered the standard for legendary.
Is there anything you're not doing? Are you saving babies from wells or anything like that in your spare time?
Pulling orphans from burning buildings?
Exactly. Now, I know how busy you are, and I can't thank you enough for doing this. But, it's just fascinating, your career, and I want listeners and fans of the podcast to know more about sort of how you got to where you got. You are the preeminent broadcaster and sports broadcaster in my mind in the country, and you grew up in Queens and went to Syracuse, and you started announcing for the Syracuse Blazers minor league hockey team, which was like essentially a great job for a kid, I would imagine, right? What was that?
It was
like
a fantastic job, not to get rich from, 30 bucks a game and $5 a day meal money on the road. It was a bus league. Syracuse was part of basically the Slapshot League, the Paul Newman movie Slapshot.
I was gonna
based on that league.
Like that, yeah.
Based on that league, and the character Ogie Oglethorpe is directly based on Bill Harpo Goldthorpe, who was an enforcer and a brawler who played with the Syracuse Blazers, a guy whom I knew and described the play-by-play of his games when I was the radio voice of the Syracuse Blazers in 1973 when I was a senior at Syracuse. That's right.
Oh, my God. You just moved up a notch in my eyes that you were part of that lore. I mean, that's one of my favorite movies of all time.
So that not only that, Paul, I actually knew a lot of the guys who were extras in the movie. The Johnstown Jets had a goaltender named Ned Dowd, and his sister wrote the screenplay for Slapshot. So she knew the league inside and out. And obviously they took some artistic license and created some additional characters and some additional absurdities. But at its heart, that was the Eastern Hockey League.
Wow. And so although, as you say, they took some liberties and artistic license, but the core of it, I mean, those bus rides, those hotel rooms, that lifestyle, the old over-the-hill guys, the guys trying to make their way up, all pretty accurate. And Paul Newman's character based on a particular person that you remember back then?
No, but there were guys who had played in the National Hockey League who were just kind of hanging on to a hockey career. Or guys who basically, this is, when I was there in 1973, you're less than a decade removed from when the NHL was a six-team league. Mm. So there were lifetime minor league players who today would have had long careers in the NHL and made millions of dollars. I mean, there was a very small pool of players who were actually in the NHL. And there were guys who played for teams in higher minor leagues, like the American Association, teams like the Hershey Bears and whatnot, that were minor league legends. And in these bus leagues, or beer leagues, as they were sometimes called, the 3,000 or 4,000 who came to the Johnstown War Memorial to see the Johnstown Jets, or the Syracuse War Memorial to see the Blazers, or to watch the Clinton Comets in upstate New York, or the Maine Nordiques play in the Nordiques played in the same high school arena. Their rink was the arena where Ali fought Liston for the second time in Lewiston, Maine, and knocked him out in the first round. And the famous Neil Leifer picture of Ali scowling over the fallen Liston, because Ali was at that point a very controversial figure, it was difficult to get very many state boxing commissions to sanction a title fight. And Maine was willing to do it. So the second Liston Ali fight took place in 1965 in that little town of Lewiston, Maine.
Incredible. Yeah, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and we had the Rhode Island Reds. And the Rhode Island Red Rooster was the mascot, or if you will, the bird, unofficial state bird. And they played, it was like a Thunderdome. Like, there was no plexiglass. It was this sort of narrow, tiny fencing. And in this un-air-conditioned, just disgusting building, and there'd be 2,000-3,000 people. Everybody was smoking. I remember my dad taking me there, and
right.
You would just see, and you were right up. It didn't matter where you were sitting; you were pretty much right on the ice. And to this day, like, that whole environment, it's so different now than going to a Major League Hockey game. And I a couple of these names that you mentioned, I remember coming through town as part of that league, and but I had no idea that you were sort of part of that that amazing lore of Slapshot. That's great. But then how did you go from Syracuse to St. Louis? And professionally, you started in radio at KMOX in St. Louis. You did play for Spirit of St. Louis ABA ball and the Missouri Tigers. How did that connection happen?
Well, while I was at Syracuse and in my senior year, like I said, doing minor league hockey and going to school at the same time, the Carolina Cougars of the ABA moved to St. Louis to become the Spirits of St. Louis. And I got word that they were looking for a radio announcer. So I tossed my tape, as it were, rather than my hat, into the ring. And I was lucky enough to land that job. At age 22, I sent them a tape of a game I'd done between Syracuse and Rutgers on the campus station during my sophomore or junior year at Syracuse, and I guess it was halfway decent, and that coupled with the fact that I was willing to work very, very cheap probably helped me clinch the job.
I imagine radio is a great place to start for any broadcaster, right, because you don't have the benefit of visuals. You have to tell the story efficiently and colorfully and to really explain to the viewer, the listener, what's happening. But then once you make the transition to TV, you sort of need to back off on some over-explaining. Like, how was that the best route for you, in your opinion, to start on radio and have that?
You've got it exactly right. I think it's much more difficult for someone whose background is entirely in television to transition to radio than the other way around. In radio, you're the entire thing, basically. It's entirely a broadcaster's medium. Production is at a minimum. All you got to do is flip the switch so that to make sure that there's a broadcast line. But there are no graphics. There are no shifting shots. The color broadcaster has less of a proportion of the broadcast because description is primary. So the play-by-play man is truly number one on radio. And as Vin Scully has put it eloquently as usual, on radio they give you a blank canvas, a bucket of paint, and a brush. And you paint the whole thing. Whereas on television, basically you're putting a caption, you hope deftly, but you're putting a caption beneath a picture that already exists.
Well, you had a big moment in 84, the game of the week, the Sandberg game, where he hits those two amazing home runs. And I've always wondered, you know, I'm a performer myself, and on some level, I think, you know, what you do is performance, obviously, and it's sort of knowing when to get out of the way is as important as knowing when to say something or step in. And like, but if you sense there's that moment that could about to happen, do you start to sort of in your mind script, okay, if he hits this home run, I'm going to say this?
Or no.
Because your line was, do you believe it when he hits the second? If you want to tell people the background of this, quickly, the story of Sandberg and his amazing two home runs he hits in this game, and you had a great call on it.
Well, the Cubs, you know, had been pretty much in their usual state in the years prior to 1984, And then Dallas Green came in as their general manager, and they began to put together a contending team, and it all sort of came together for them in the 1984 season. Ryan Sandberg was a young player who had been acquired in a deal with Philadelphia, and he was emerging as a superstar. But this was his first true national stage. The game of the week really was the game of the week then. Before the internet. ESPN had begun, right? I'm sorry?
It was you and Tony Kubek, right?
It was me and Tony Kubek. Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola did the main game, but often there were two national games on a given Saturday. And this one was seen over the entire country. And, you know, ESPN existed, but it had only been in existence a while, and the coverage was not as comprehensive as it is now. The internet did not exist. Superstations were in their infancy. Most teams didn't televise as many local games, not nearly as many as they do now. So if you were a baseball fan, especially in a non-major league city, it's very possible the only game you saw on television all week long was that Saturday afternoon game. And real baseball fans, you know, wouldn't mow the lawn between 1 and 4 Eastern time on a Saturday afternoon because they would be watching first Kurt Gowdy or Joe Garagiola and later Vin Scully and Joe and me and Tony Kubek. So here is Ryan Sandberg kind of emerging on the national stage and putting together. He's right in the middle of what would turn out to be an MVP season. The Cubs are establishing themselves as contenders, and the Cardinals take a 9-3 lead in this game, and the Cubs come back and make it close. They make it 9-8, going to the bottom of the ninth. Mm-hmm. Bruce Sutter is the Cardinals' closer, but back then the closer didn't just work the ninth. Sutter came on in the seventh, which was not at all unusual. Closers like Raleigh Fingers and Goose Gossage and Sutter in that era would go through the lineup a couple of times, pitch three innings, sometimes even four if necessary. So you got Sutter on the mound. It's the Cardinals against the Cubs, which is a deep and traditional rivalry, but without the kind of animosity that Yankees and Red Sox have. It's a more friendly rivalry, but it's for real and it's historic. And so probably 25% of the fans at Wrigley that day are wearing Cardinal red. It's a beautiful classic Saturday afternoon in a beautiful classic old ballpark. At one point I said, you know, it could just as well be 1954 as 1984. The way this game is playing out and the whole atmosphere surrounding it, I said to Kubek, the only difference is that I think we're in color now, and we would have been in black and white then. Willie McGee hit for the cycle, which has since been forgotten. McGee hit for the cycle in the game for the Cardinals. Ozzie Smith made a number of eye-popping plays at shortstop. And we go to the bottom of the ninth, 9-8, and Sandberg, who already had three hits, hits a home run into the left center field bleachers off Sutter to tie the game.
Which was big because he's not known for his power. He was not considered a power guy, right?
No, although later in his career he had one season, I think, where he hit 40 home runs. And he was, in the prime of his career, about a 25 home run guy, as I remember. Right. And he hit over 20 that season when he was the MVP. But, you know, he certainly wasn't Babe Ruth. Anyway, he hits the first homer. And after the Cardinals take a two-run lead in extra innings, he comes up again with two outs and a man on, down 11-9, and Sutter still pitching, and he hits another home run to almost exactly the same spot. The same fan almost could have caught both home run balls. And I guess that was the one where do you believe it was part of the call. But that was just what popped into my head at
but
that
you're
moment.
Not sitting there going, okay, which is the right thing to do, I imagine, because then it becomes artificial in some level, on some level.
Yeah, you know, I think there are sometimes, let's say if somebody is leading by five strokes on the back nine of a major, you might be able to think of something, and I don't find myself in that position because I'm not the lead broadcaster of golf, but you might be able to think of something in that circumstance. I would hope you wouldn't script it, but think of a point you might want to make or an observation you might want to make, because you can see where the story is going. If some team has the lead by three touchdowns in the fourth quarter of the Super Bowl, and it's the Patriots, and it's going to be Tom Brady's fourth Super Bowl win, you start to think, well, and now he's equaled Joe Montana, and he's actually appeared in more Super Bowls than anybody as a starting quarterback. So you begin to think that those are among the things that you'll include in your comments. but they shouldn't be scripted comments. And if the game is too close to know, if it's seesawing back and forth, a good example would be when Michael Jordan made the shot against Utah in 1998 to win the NBA title for the sixth time for the Bulls. I'm calling that game. There's no way in the world you can know how that game's going to turn out, and no way in the world you're going to know that he's going to hit that basket exactly that way in that moment with 5 seconds to go in the game. So whatever you say has to be whatever occurs to you just in that moment.
Yeah, it's got to be organic. So where, I mean, I remember reading something that you as a kid, would you listen to baseball on radio as a kid? Like, where did this passion for sports come from and this passion for broadcasting sports come from? Is this
Well, I, you know, like millions of other kids, I followed sports. My dad was a sports fan, and he and I bonded in that way. And I was always fascinated by the broadcasters, whether it was radio or television. The broadcasters were almost as interesting to me as the players. And it was a golden era of
broadcasting.
Why do you
think that is? Like, that's interesting that a young person was it just because they were so captivating in the way they were describing the games?
Yeah, I was lucky to grow up in New York in the late 50s and early 60s. And although Vin Scully had left with the Dodgers, I did spend a little bit of time in Southern California when I was a kid, and I listened to Vin quite a bit. And then back in New York, you still had Marty Glickman calling ball games. You had Lindsey Nelson on the Mets. You had Mel Allen and Red Barber, who had moved over from the Dodgers to the Yankees. You had a lot of those classic voices, Chris Schenkel on national television. There's so many. I'm leaving guys out. That they weren't just good craftsmen. There was a certain artistry to it. There was a certain melody to the game, especially on radio, the way they called it, that was almost enchanting to me. In fact, it was enchanting. And to me, the game was not complete without that soundtrack. So again, I'm sure I wasn't alone in this. You'd be in the schoolyard shooting baskets or throwing a tennis ball off a brick wall or playing wiffle ball or something, and you'd be doing your own play-by-play. You'd be hearing Mel Allen or the young Marv Albert or somebody like that in your head, and that's how it took hold for me.
Yeah, Johnny Most was big for me. I mean, Johnny Most called the Celtics games for years, and I was a Boy Scout in Providence. I remember they were in a playoff, and we all were camping, but we all went to the Scoutmaster's car and sat around his car and listened on the radio, and that voice, and then, of course, that famous, Havlicek stole the ball, that famous call, you know. And the artistry versus the technique is fascinating to me in the sense of, the artistry, is it the timbre of the voice? It's sort of where to place the emphasis, all of that, or is that more technique? I mean, is the artistry something you're just born with, or do you develop that as a broadcast, do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Johnny Most, because especially in the days before this total saturation where, you know, everybody can listen to everything or see everything if they want to in some way or other, the local broadcaster had a special hold on the imagination of that team's fan base. A guy like Johnny Most, and I say this with respect, if you had a dozen people put their audition tapes into a hat, Johnny Most would never get the job with that gravelly voice. He didn't sound anything like what you thought an announcer should sound like. A transcript of his broadcast would not necessarily place him in the upper echelon, but he made rooting for and caring about the Celtics sound like it was a civic responsibility. You know, and people identified with that. They identified with his passion. He was openly biased. You know, they connected with that. And to them, and of course, he was fortunate enough to be their voice when they were an untouchable dynasty. So he's the soundtrack of all of that. If he had been the voice at the same time of the Cincinnati Royals, let's say, good as they were with Oscar Robertson and Jack Twyman and others, he would not have been as legendary in Cincinnati as he was in Boston because there were no championships. So, you know, it's kind of a perfect storm.
Yeah, and well, I mean, those local, it's interesting you say that because sort of with the nationalization of sports broadcasting, for lack of a better term, you know, there's sort of this almost required objectivity in some way in the broadcasters. And, you know, I live in New York City, but I'm an old Boston guy because I grew up in Rhode Island. And I like listening now. It's Tommy Heinsohn is the closest thing you get to it. I like hearing him go, they're mauling him. They're mauling Pierce under the bat. You know what I mean? You
right.
get that. And it creates another level of investment in you as a listener that I think gets lost. And don't get me wrong. The national broadcasters are great and they do a great job. But that sort of local flavor just makes it all that much more entertaining and interesting, which I think gets lost in the shuffle a little bit now.
And, yeah, I agree with you, and that's why I understand when local fans still, to this day, local fans are always convinced that every network announcer is rooting against their team. Every announcer who has ever done a World Series or a Super Bowl or an NBA final will yeah. tell you that they got equal numbers of complaints from fans of either team.
Oh, really?
Hearing the same broadcast, Okay. I can recall doing World Series, seeing the Indians and the Marlins, and hearing from both Marlin fans that I was biased in favor of the Indians, and from Indian fans that I was biased in favor of the Marlins. And, you know, Joe Buck gets it every year on the World Series, and yeah. fans just, and then very often the fan will say, why can't they be more objective, like, and then they'll name their hometown town announcer, because to them, objectivity is defined as rooting just as passionately and irrationally for their team as they are. That would be perfect objectivity on their part. And they just don't appreciate that it's the job of the national broadcaster, not just to be fair, but to reflect what's happening. If one team is truly dominating the other, if it's a four-game sweep or something like that, then naturally the commentary is going to be more positive in favor of that team. Mm-hmm. But even if the thing goes seven and goes right down to the wire, the local fan, or at least many of them, are going to perceive some slighting of their team or some storyline that they're aware of that the national audience isn't getting. It's a phenomenon that happens every single time.
I can imagine, too, and fans being as pushy as they can be, probably come up to you in a restaurant, hey, Costas, and they probably just start, right? They give you their opinion right to your face, I imagine, too. They're not
you know what? About. In person, 99.999% positive. Social media these days, which I don't pay any attention to, but
yeah.
that kind of stuff, you know, it, to the extent that I'm aware of it, that's just like just an open invitation for anybody to vent, no matter how irrationally or mean-spiritedly. And what people might have said behind your back at any time, no matter who you are, you can never fully account for. But what none of us have ever received is a letter that goes something like this. Dear Mr. Gowdy, dear Mr. Buck, dear Mr. Nance, dear Mr. Michaels, dear Mr. Costas, I am a fan of neither the San Francisco 49ers nor the Baltimore Ravens. I had no rooting interest in the game. However, as I watched from my home in Montana, and as an aside, I'm a Seahawks fan, but as I watched, I perceived a bias on your part against the Baltimore Ravens. No one has ever received any such letter in the entire history of broadcasting.
Right.
I am a fan of neither team, but I perceived a bias on your part against such and such a team. It has never occurred.
That is so funny. I'll tell you who does a good job, not as a homer, but like is really calls out the league more so and the ref situation at times is Jeff Van Gundy. In terms of, you know, he gets very irritated when they'll call double technical fouls when there's a fight. You know, he calls out, and I admire. It's the closest thing I can think of to sort of a more old time broadcaster in the sense of like he's not necessarily trying to be so objective and non-controversial that he's not sort of acknowledging the elephant in the room, and I admire him for that. You know?
Yeah, I love Van Gundy for a number of reasons, including his very quirky sense of humor and the fact that when he's on camera, he never cracks a smile.
I know.
He just looks like a wax figure. He just stares straight ahead, and that it's in and of itself is somehow oddly amusing to me.
Right. Well, I would imagine, I haven't been to a broadcasting school class, but I would imagine he'd be the this is what not to do model of on-camera broadcasting. And then he gets irritated very easily on air, which I love. Like, there's a realness to him
Right.
Is very, very infectious, for me anyway. And how difficult was it for you starting out in play-by-play? I mean, you pretty much do, and you've done, people don't know, I've done buzz and play-by-play for basketball, baseball, hockey, you've done golf, I mean, you've covered everything. How hard is the transition in talking about, I'm fascinated by process and how people do their job. Transitioning from being a play-by-play announcer to a host, and what are the different skill sets you need that don't necessarily cross over in those jobs?
Well, you know, it's hard to describe unless you have done it. At the time that I first made the switch, and it wasn't a 100% switch because I continued to do play-by-play of baseball in the 80s and then returned to basketball for a while in the 90s. But when I first made the switch in the 1980s, I had never really done any studio hosting. I'd done radio and television play-by-play. I'd never even seen a teleprompter. The first 4 or 5 years that I hosted football and then later basketball for NBC, I did it without a teleprompter. I would just have notes and just ad-lib stuff. And then eventually the productions became more complicated, and they would need to know at least what words or phrases to go to this graphic on or this bit of footage on, and then we started to rely on the teleprompter a bit more because it made it easier all around production-wise. And then you develop a facility for that, or at least you hope you do, where people can't tell whether, in some cases, whether you're actually reading it or you're ad-libbing it. And a lot of times I'll throw in asides and parenthetical things, and then I'll come back to what's on the prompter. And the man or woman who operates the teleprompter has figured that out and learns to kind of roll with the punches with me, because I don't necessarily go straight from top to bottom.
I would imagine the Olympic coverage is a fair amount of that, right? Because things seem to be moving at a pretty fast pace in that studio, I would imagine.
Well, it depends upon whether it's live or whether it's taped. If it's a taped Olympics, like the London Olympics were in prime time, then pretty much all of that can be scripted. I mean, I'll still occasionally ad-lib something, but you're not doing it in real time. In Beijing, for example, the time difference was so extreme that a lot of what we did was, in fact, live. So things were happening right then. It might have been 10 o'clock in the morning in Beijing, but it was prime time the previous night back in the States, and so we were live. So each Olympics is different.
You broadcast with Bob Uecker, among other people, and Pat Riley. What was Bob Uecker is endlessly entertaining to me. What was it? Are there any great? And I don't want to compromise anything too private. You don't have to say. But what was it like working with him? And secondly, are there any great? I would imagine you guys, you're done broadcasting, you'll get a steak and a beer afterwards or something. What was it like, sort of broadcasting with him and being on the road? Any good stories there?
Well, he's instantly recognizable, especially in that era. He's still an institution in Milwaukee, but in the 80s and 90s, he was in all the Miller Lite commercials, Mr. Baseball. Exactly, right? Got my seats down here in the front row. He missed the tag after they banished him to the upper reaches of the upper deck. So he's in all those commercials. He was in the television show Mr. Belvedere. He had national exposure as a baseball announcer. The Major League movies, for my money, he's the best thing in the Major League movies, as Harry Doyle, just a bit outside. He tried the corner and missed. And he had lived a huge percentage of that. A lot of that stuff wasn't on the script. A huge percentage. And he is one of the most genuinely funny, quick-witted people I've ever been around in my whole life. Yeah. And so it was a joy to be with him. It was easy to broadcast alongside him because he could take as much or as little as necessary. And I kind of knew some of his great stories and anecdotes when I'm being friends with him and areas that would be fertile for him. So when I could, I would steer the broadcast, you know, kind of throw him a fat one right over the heart of the plate so he could knock it out of the park. And he didn't need much help. You just got him to a certain subject, and he would have an anecdote or a one-liner. And I knew him well enough to be a good setup man for that.
Oh, that's great. And I would imagine And Pat Riley, what was it like broadcasting with him? I mean, he seems like a pretty intense guy. Was that?
Well, he was very intense then. You know, it was just 1 year. He was between having just left the Lakers, where he was a legend as the maestro of Showtime, and then he took the Knicks job the very next year. And, you know, he had a certain image and a certain standing, not just in basketball, but in pop culture. And he hadn't done all that much television. So he relied on me pretty heavily. And he and I became good friends because of it. And I basically told him, look, don't worry about any of the mechanics. I'll handle all the mechanics of getting to and from the commercials and to the highlights and everything. Just talk to me and talk to the audience and forget about all the bells and whistles. Let me deal with that. And I think that once he was comfortable that would be taken care of, he became better.
Well, yeah, someone as brilliant as you let somebody like that shine. I mean, but I've been mad at you since you stopped doing your show later on NBC. I watched that show religiously. For people out there who don't know, Bob had a one-on-one interview show on NBC at 1:30 after the Late Night with David Letterman. It was Carson, Letterman, and then you for 10 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Six.
And we'll
close, close to 10. Six. 88 to 94.
Yeah, let's just round it up. And I would watch that show really. Very simple set, one-on-one. Only other person that did a show like that, Tom Snyder at one time. And you would hold over some guests, and you held over for four consecutive nights Mel Brooks and interviewed Mel Brooks. How fun was that? And was that just was that one fell swoop of taping that was broken up? And what was that like? I mean, was it just you were just along for the ride, or because I still remember some of those shows, and your research was brilliant. Also, like you had detailed questions that I never heard anybody else ask anybody.
Well, we had a tremendous staff, and they knew that in me they had a host who actually was eager for some depth in research. I didn't want just some superficial stuff. You're going to spend at least half an hour with a single guest, and you didn't want it to be just boilerplate stuff. And very often, when someone who's been interviewed frequently is asked questions that they're not usually asked, or when they see that you have enough knowledge or enough respect for them and for what this interview entails to have gone out and found out something interesting or off the beaten track about them, then they tend to respond more openly. And then you don't have to do very much. Then you just get out of the way and they start telling stories and you pretty much just take it from there. So I give a lot of credit to the staff. We had four producers and we had a show that ran Monday through Thursday. That wasn't a Friday night show. NBC had a late night show then called Friday Night Videos. Think of how quaint that is these days. But so each of the four producers would take one guest a week on average and give me a fairly detailed packet of research about that person. And I always found it interesting, so I would, you know, soak it all in. And it came in handy in those conversations. And like you say, if the person was interesting enough and their career was substantial enough, we'd keep them over and do a double, you know, tape two right there. There were a few like Paul McCartney and Paul Simon, who we got three shows out of in a single sitting. Yeah. And then there was one, Mel Brooks, who became a whole week because he was just on fire. Yeah. He was just so freaking funny that no one wanted to leave. And so we just let him keep going. We just stop and say, all right, we'll be back tomorrow. We'll be back tomorrow.
Were there any curveballs or anything that came at you from him that you just, like, anything that stands out that he said or did, like, where you just, like, you did not see that coming? I mean, he's so off the wall once he gets going in those interviews, but I don't know if anything stands out, but I just was fascinated.
Well, you know, he subsequently has told a number of these stories, but this was like in 1991 or something, and they had not been publicly told. And Blazing Saddles was more present in people's minds. That generation of viewers were more familiar with the comedy classic Blazing Saddles, which for its time really pushed the envelope. Mm-hmm. And he gave me some insight, and the audience some insight, into what his strategy was. He purposely would put five or six things that he knew the censors would object to in with the idea that he would horse trade with them. and protect the couple that he really wanted to keep, the ones that he thought were really good. Then he would purposely put in three or four extra that he knew would get their noses out of joint, and then he'd say, all right, how about if we get rid of that? Yeah, we'll get rid of that. But just let us keep the farting around the campfire. We got to keep that. But we'll get rid of the other thing over here, okay? And then they go for it.
Unbelievable. That's so classic. Any possibility of you going back to doing more sort of entertainment-oriented talk? Because you're so good at it. But
you can't do everything all at once. I don't know. You know, sometime down the road when the circumstances allow, maybe you never say never. Who knows?
Where did your big passion for baseball come? I mean, for people out there who may not know, at one time you carried a 1958 Mickey Mantle card in your wallet.
You still do.
You still do.
Still
good
do.
For you. That's,
well,
that's,
if I threw it away now, it'd be sacrilege, right?
and why that particular card? Why is that card significant for you?
1958 was the first year that I can remember collecting baseball cards. I was six. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first Mickey Mantle card that popped out of a pack of Tops with that chalky bubble gum attached to the five or six cards that came in a pack that you got for a nickel.
Yeah.
So that was my first Mickey Mantle card.
That gum,
not his rookie card, but it was my first one.
Your first one. That gum had chew in it for about 30 seconds, and then it just was disgusting.
If you dropped it on the sidewalk, it would shatter like glass.
Exactly.
On the other hand, whatever player was face up, his card face up against the gum.
Yeah.
Archaeologists, long after our civilization has disappeared, archaeologists from a future species or something, future inhabitants of Earth, will unearth a 1962 Bob Perky. And there will still be the residue of that gum and the faint fragrance of that gum when they pull it out of the rubble of Crosley Field.
I can smell that right now. You're absolutely right. And that little powdery substance that was on whatever that was. Oh, God. And you also, as a damn usual, I know you did his eulogy. Unfortunately, recently passed away, and you left a $3.31 tip one time at his restaurant in St. Louis as a tribute to his lifetime batting average of .331.
I want to make it clear that the whole tab was less than $10. It was 1974. So I wasn't being a cheapskate. In fact, I was actually tipping at a very high rate. I'm sure the waiter appreciated the percentage of the tip, if not the meaning of
it. Well, you think things through. Maybe you ordered just the right amount, backing into your order based on the tip that you knew you were going to leave. How about that?
I wish I could take credit for that, but it was 1974. It was the first time I ever set foot in Stan Musial's restaurant in St. Louis, which was on Oakland Avenue next to the old arena where the St. Louis Blues and briefly the Spirits played. And I went in there by myself and I ordered a hamburger. And I guess it probably cost $8 or something, you know, the total tab. And I left $3.31 because Stan the Man's lifetime average was $3.31.
Now, why of all, I mean, obviously you're passionate about sports, but what is it about baseball that maybe sits a little closer to your heart than the other sports?
Well, it has the deepest and longest history.
Yeah.
The pace of the game is a good pace for a certain kind of announcer. Mm-hmm. It's conversational. It's anecdotal. Mm-hmm. You can relate to a partner in the booth, I think, in a different way than in other sports. Mm-hmm. It's the best of all the sports on radio. If you have a good baseball announcer on the radio, then it's something really special. Mm-hmm. And it just got into my head and into my imagination early on. I love basketball. It's probably my second favorite sport, both NBA and college. And I like almost all sports, but baseball has definitely always been my favorite.
I know we got to let you go in a couple of minutes, but I just want you got to do something which blows me away for your 40th birthday. Tony La Russa let you manage a spring training game of the Cardinals. Is that right?
No, Oakland A's. He was still a manager of the Oakland A's then.
Oh, Oakland A's. Sorry. And what was that like? I mean, was it harder than it looked? I mean,
first thing, they had to find a uniform that would fit me. And the closest they had was one of Mike Gallego's uniforms, utility man, sometime second baseman. who stood about 5'8 and weighed about 160. And I go about 5'7 and 150. So it was a little loose, but it was as close as I sure as hell wasn't going to wear Canseco or Maguire's uniform. So, or Dave Parker's, if he was still with them then.
Right.
So anyway, so I get the uniform and, you know, I try to make it look as decent as I can. And, you know, even though the players all knew me and they were all nice to me.
Yeah.
And even though I feel very comfortable at a ballpark and very comfortable in street clothes or a network blazer leaning up against a batting cage or sitting in a dugout or walking into a clubhouse,
yeah,
you know that, you know, the last time you wore a baseball uniform was in high school, you know, or in Little League, and you know that you're really kind of an alien there. But the players were nice to me, and La Russa was great to me. He and I had been friends already for quite a long time. And the thing that I kind of knew in general, but you really experience it moment to moment, is that managing a baseball team is not just, do I take the pitcher out now? Do I send the pinch hitter up now?
Mm-hmm.
Do I put the steal sign on? Do we hit and run? It actually changes from pitch to pitch. It's a mentally exhausting thing if you're into it the way Tony La Russa was into it. Because in the same at-bat, a 2-1 pitch was an entirely different strategic situation in his mind than a 2-2 pitch.
Right.
And what signs he would give, what he would leave to his players to their own discretion, even in a spring training game, mm-hmm. would literally change from pitch to pitch, not just batter to batter or inning to inning. And I realized how much you have to bear down, how much you have to concentrate if you're going to manage a game that way.
Yeah, and you have to do that 160 times. It's a long season. It's a long, long season. Well, listen, I know you have to get going. I don't want to keep you. I would love to talk to you more because there's stuff we haven't even gotten to that I wanted to talk to you about. Maybe we can do another one of these down the road. But I can't thank you enough for your time. I know how busy you are. Do you have any advice for anybody out there who wants to get into broadcasting in this day and age? I know it's a different era than when you started, but I always like to leave people with...
It's a much different era, and in some ways, the craft has been diminished by a lot of what I see out there, but there are still a vast number of very talented people, and many of them are talented young people, broadcasters, producers, people with a point of view. So, you know, there's still good work out there beckoning if you're capable of doing it and if you're willing to put in the time to become good at your craft. And what I've always said to young people is get as well-rounded an education as you can for two reasons. One, it may not pan out or you may change your mind. You may not want to be a sports broadcaster or a broadcaster at all. And so a well-rounded education will help you in general. But if you do become a broadcaster, the better your general knowledge of the world, obviously you want to have specific knowledge of the sport or sports you cover, but the better your general knowledge of the world, or through reading, the better your appreciation of language is, then almost by osmosis, in some small way at least, that's going to make you a better broadcaster. So that's all the advice I can offer, and the rest is just kind of a crapshoot, hard work and some good luck.
All right, folks, that was Bob Costas. Very cool that he called games for the minor league hockey team that was the basis for the hockey team in Slapshot. That's my favorite thing ever. And the movie Slapshot is up there with Caddyshack and Blues Brothers and Animal House. And if you don't know Slapshot and you haven't seen it, you just need to leave the country now. Please spread the word about the podcast. Send links around to your friends, family. And come check me out September 30, October 1st at the Rhode Island Comedy Connection. All right. Thanks for checking out the podcast, everybody.